Hi, I'm Robin, and I'm an alcoholic. I didn't drink for a long period of time. I drank for a little over a year. The history of my drinking prior to drinking. I grew up in a home that my parents really, I never saw either one of them drink too much. But I do know that, you know, their parents had alcoholism. So I grew up essentially in a home where I lived with adult children of alcoholics. And they had all of the sick behavior that went with that, the sick ways of dealing with things, and passed that on to my sister and I. So when I grew up, I didn't have an understanding of really how to live life and to properly function in society. I don't believe that's what made me an alcoholic, but I believe it's definitely a part of what led me to want that first drink. I had one sibling, a sister. She ended up having another illness, you know, another addiction. And we both really struggled with a lot of things growing up. I always felt like a misfit, like I never fit in. Excuse me. And I never felt like I fit in. I didn't feel like I fit in at school. I didn't feel like I fit in my home. I was bullied at school quite a bit, and never felt like I had any recourse. I wasn't taught how to fight back. I wasn't taught how to stand up for myself. I had no self-confidence and tons of unfounded, ungrounded fear and anxiety. I felt unsafe and I felt unloved in my home. And it was a very painful, lonely existence. At the age of 15, I picked up my first drink. I was almost 16, and I picked up my first drink. And I remember, you know, drinking alone and loving the feeling that it gave me. I drank a beer, and I know I drank some gin. I remember that I got sick, but I didn't care about that. All I cared about was that wonderful, warm glow, that feeling it gave me, that all of a sudden I felt like it was the answer. I could be anything, I could do anything, I could say anything, and I didn't care if you didn't like me, and nothing else mattered except that next drink. I fell instantly in love with alcohol, and I wanted that feeling 24 hours a day and 7 days a week. And that became my mission. You know, after that first drink, I was off and running. Within a period of a couple of weeks, I was drinking daily. I was drinking around the clock. I found any way that I could to get alcohol. You know, I was too young to buy, but I had a part-time job after school at a nursing home kitchen. I would steal booze from there. I would steal booze from my family. We always had a supply in the basement, you know, for when they had parties. And I would take little bits off of every bottle and slug it down. And you know, it would taste horrible. But I didn't drink for the taste. I didn't drink for socializing. I drank for the effect. And I would steal it from people that I babysat for. I would drink when I babysat. Instantly I had a loss of values. I would date guys that were old enough to buy just because they were old enough to buy and not because I cared about them or that they were nice people. Most of them were real jerks. But I didn't care because they could supply alcohol. At the beginning of my drinking, you know, I would drink and I became jovial and funny and I'd be invited to parties. And I was fun. You know, and at the end of my drinking, you know, when it, like I said, it was only a little bit over a year, you know, but at the end, nobody wanted me around because I became one of those alcoholic women, you know, that most people can't stand at a party. You know, I'd be the one that would be slurring my words and, you know, telling you exactly what I thought of you. And it wasn't pretty, you know, so I wasn't being invited anywhere anymore. And, you know, that wonderful feeling of now fitting in a round hole again, you know, the round peg in the round hole that alcohol gave me in the beginning, you know, I was now again a square peg in a round hole. And I just felt awful. You know, it was like I had a black hole in my soul, you know, and I just couldn't function anymore. At the end of my drinking, I was drinking all day. nipping and sipping, sneaking it into school, drinking between classes, drinking before I went up to my bus stop, you know, chewing the gum and the Tic Tacs, and lying to my parents all the time, lying to my family, hiding it, doing anything I could to get more. And I was basically mocus all day long. And then at the end of the day was my favorite drink, which was that warm bottle of vodka that was waiting for me in my desk drawer, you know, where I kept everything. You know, I was smoking cigarettes at this point. I was smoking pot. And my family had no idea. You know, my parents had me late in life. My mother was 39 when she had me. And we were several generations apart. And they just had no clue. You know, they knew that I was changing, and that a lot of there were a lot of changes in my attitude, the way I dressed, the way I looked. You know, when I was a teenager, they kind of attributed it to that. But they also, you know, my mother kind of thought it was the heavy metal music. You know, I laugh about that. But they had no clue, and I hid it well from them. What I understand today is that I have a threefold illness, you know, and when I look back at my drinking, I can see it so clearly. You know, it's mental, it's physical, it's spiritual. And for me, the mental part was every time I picked up a drink, you know, somewhere in the back of my mind, whether it was conscious or unconscious, I always had that thought that this time it'll be different. You know, every time I picked up a drink, I really believed that it would be like the first time I picked up a drink. And it would be just that wonderful glow, and it would make me feel good. You know, and I would pick up that drink. And as soon as I picked up that drink, you know, when it got in my system, I had the physical part of this illness. And the physical part was the compulsion. And every time I picked up a drink, it always called for another. You know, whether I could have it or not didn't matter. You know, it always called for another. And if I could have, I would have been drunk 24 hours a day, you know, 7 days a week. You know, I craved it. I craved it all the time. And I thought about it all the time. You know, the mental obsession, that's part of the obsession. And then the loss of spiritual values. You know, I didn't lose any big things. I was young. I didn't have a husband. I didn't have a house. I didn't have a car. You know, but the things that I lost, you know, the loss of spiritual values, you know, in school my grades had gone from A's and B's to C's, D's and F's, you know, and I blamed people, places and things. I blamed the teachers, you know, they didn't like me. It wasn't my fault. I fought with my family all the time. I would pick fights so that I could go in my room and just slam the door and then drink. I would, you know, I remember, for me, you know, the one of the vivid memories I have is at Christmas time, you know, we'd all sit in this, you know, this room that we had. It was like a little living room and you know, kind of dating myself, but we had beanbag chairs and I remember sitting in the beanbag chair and opening up presents with my family and not wanting to be there. I wanted to be in the basement getting drunk. The end of my drinking, you know, it created total isolation for me. I wanted to be alone, even though I was really lonely. And, you know, and only an alcoholic understands the loneliness of an alcoholic. But I hated myself, and I hated everybody around me, and I wanted to be by myself and just feel sorry for myself. And that was the end of my drinking, and it was a really sad place, and I felt like the world would be better off without me. I didn't want to continue to live the way that I was living. Alcohol wasn't doing what I wanted it to do. It wasn't making me feel good anymore. It was making things worse, but I couldn't see that it was the alcohol that was keeping me sick. You know, I still, in my sick mind, thought it was my best friend. And at the end of my drinking, I started making suicide attempts. In 1 week's time, I made a couple of attempts. I took bottles of pills. I didn't know what I was taking. I knew, you know, in the movies you see somebody takes a bottle of pills, they die. Well, that wasn't the case. I, you know, what I took just made me sick. And the last attempt that I made was very serious. I took a prescription that my mother needed. It was for a blood thinner. And I left her one pill in the bottle, you know, because I knew she'd need it for the next morning. So, I still had some compassion and caring for other people. But I thought I had taken 10 of these pills, you know, in my mocha state. I drank a half a pint of vodka. I smoked a joint. And then I went to bed and I slipped my wrists. And it's not a pretty picture. And I don't ever want to forget that. I don't ever want to forget that moment in my life, because that is where alcohol will take me again, if not worse, if I pick up again. You know, it's very clear to me what alcohol did to me. There's no doubt in my mind that this disease wants me dead. You know, that's the ultimate aim of alcoholism, is to kill us. My sister found me. It was around 3 a.m, and she never checked on me, but for some reason she checked on me that night. She came into my room and she found me. And they called an ambulance, they got me to the hospital, I had my stomach pumped, and I was there for 10 days. They had to keep monitoring me because of the pills I had taken. I didn't realize I took 92 of these pills, they said if she had found me an hour later, I would have instantly just bled to death. And it's a miracle that they found me. And you know, I really believe it's the grace of God that got me here. It's a prayer that got me here. I remember before I went unconscious thinking, God help me, I'm a drunk. You know, and I believe he hears those desperate prayers. And so there I was in the hospital, and I didn't know what was going to happen to me. The gig was up, and part of me felt relief. You know, part of me absolutely felt relief that, you know, my family knew what was happening, and that it was like I could be honest. And my mother had found the cigarettes, you know, so now I could smoke in the open. And they found all the alcohol. My sister found the pot. She made brownies. And my mother probably thought, you know, why does she have oregano on her desk? You know, she had no clue. But that's where my journey began. I was there for 10 days, and then our family doctor thought it would be a good idea if I went away and got some help. And they sent me to a locked ward of a mental institution for 2.5 months. And it was there that AA found me, I believe, and I'm so grateful. I started going to meetings there. I remember the first meeting I went to, totally confused, you know, not knowing what AA was. I seemed like 500 people there. I'm sure it wasn't that big. It was an open meeting, an open speaker meeting. I remember there were some speakers that were funny, and I laughed, and I hadn't laughed in a long time. I remember, you know, leaving there, you know, feeling a little sense of hope. I went to another meeting, and the next meeting I went to was smaller. It was another speaker meeting, and I remember hearing, you know, stories, World War II stories, you know, a lady that had 8 kids, and you know, I was struggling to identify. You know, I was just turned 17 years old. I only drank for a little over a year, you know, and I thought, how could I be an alcoholic? I didn't have all the big losses. You know, how can I fit in? You know, and I wasn't sure if I was an alcoholic. You know, people drank for 20 years and they had a lot of losses, and, you know, I hadn't heard my story yet. But what I did hear, you know, I kept going to the meetings. What I did hear over and over again was they talked about the threefold illness being mental, physical, and spiritual. They talked about the feelings of the alcoholic, that absolute loneliness, the guilt, the fear, the remorse. And I totally understood that. I knew exactly what they were talking about. And that gave me the hope to keep going. When I got out of there, my family had contacted a neighbor of ours, that had been in the fellowship for some time, and he came and picked me up and brought me to meetings, you know, and I made the mistake, you know, I look back on it now, you know, and it was unknowing, you know, I didn't know what I didn't know, but I had asked him to be my sponsor, and he agreed, these days, I'll be the first to tell you, women with women, men with men. You know, what I did not realize that this individual was not a well individual. And eventually he thought it, you know, okay to 13-step me, and that was not okay. But for the grace of God, I am still here today. There are other women I know, you know, that he affected that are not here today. You know, so if you're a gal, please stick with the women. There are lots of good women with good sobriety. And if you're a guy, stick with the guys. That being said, eventually I did get a female sponsor, and that took some time. I didn't trust women. I really struggled to trust women. But the first thing I did when I got out of that institution is I went to a meeting that day. And it was the best thing I could have done. I joined a group. It was a very large group in the Lowell area at the time, and a very active group, and I was active with that group for some time. Went to meetings, you know, I didn't drink. I went to step meetings, you know, I did some of the suggestions. But somewhere in the back of my mind was always that little thought that maybe, you know, maybe this was just a phase. Maybe I'm jumping the gun. You know, am I really an alcoholic? I struggled with the age thing for a while. You know, back then, there were not a lot of young people in AA. There were some young people's groups and you could, you know, go to different towns and find young people. But in the area that I was in, there was, you know, not even a handful. And, you know, it was like no hair and gray hair at every meeting. And I struggled with that. But people kept encouraging me. You know, people kept saying things, keep coming, kid, it gets better. You know, people gave me their phone numbers. You know, people gave me rides to meetings. I didn't have a car. I'd call every day and get rides to at least a meeting a day, if not two, sometimes three. And it was wonderful. You know, the fellowship really, you know, came to bat and tried to help me. So, you know, after a while, I'd put it like the first year I put a little, I think it was like a year and a half together. And I started to cut back on meetings because my life got busy, because all that wonderful stuff, you know, sobriety had given me, I was now, you know, functioning, I could work, I was doing really well in school now, I was A's and B's again, I ended up graduating with honors, you know, I realized that I didn't kill as many brain cells as I had thought, and I went to, I cut back on these meetings, and eventually, you know, I stopped asking for help, and then eventually everybody in AA started to look like jerks. You know, and all of a sudden I was doing my own thinking. And all that old, you know, behavior and anxiety and fear came back. And within no time, a drink looked good again. And I could rationalize that drink and say, well, maybe it was just a phase. Maybe I jumped the gun. And I picked up a drink. And when I picked up a drink, it was like I had never stopped. And I don't ever want to forget that, you know. I came back with my tail between my legs and I, you know, started doing everything the way I did it before, going to meetings, asking for help, you know, trying to talk to my sponsor. I really struggled with calling my sponsor, was not really good at that, and was trying, you know, just so much pride, so much fear, and I put another year together, a little over a year, and I did the exact same thing, cut back on meetings and stopped asking for help. You know, I don't believe that resentments get us drunk, emotions get us drunk. What I really believe is complacency gets us drunk. You know, you'll hear it over and over and over again. You know, when people pick up a drink, it's because they're not, you know, they're not at meetings. They're not hearing about what happens to people who don't go to meetings. And so today I stick close. You know, I've learned if I don't get away from the basics, I don't have to get back to the basics. Anyway, the last time coming back, you know, I went on, it was just like a 3-day bender, and it really scared me because for those 3 days, every morning I'd wake up and I'd say, I'm not going to drink today, I'm going back to AA. And I'd pick up a drink, and then I couldn't stop. And the next day I'd do the same thing, and I got really scared. And that's when I understood, you know, the core of me understood the nature of this illness inside of me. I understood compulsion, that I couldn't stop on my own. And that really scared me. You know, I believe that while I am not drinking today, that my disease is doing push-ups. And it's waiting, you know, and it's growing inside of me, and it's not dormant. You know, I just, you know, it's today, one day at a time, I have a daily reprieve, and that's all I have. And I have time behind me, and that's wonderful, but all I have is this day to stay sober. I came back. A friend in the fellowship helped me to get into a treatment center. Back then, those were really popular. This was back, my sobriety date is September 6th of 1984. I went into treatment. I stayed there for a month, and it was the best thing that I could have done. You know, I really believe God was guiding me. I ended up having this wonderful counselor, this little tiny little nun. And she would put her little bony finger in my face and she would say, you know what your problem is? And I'd say, what? You know, with all the attitude that goes with it. And she'd say, you don't have the willingness to go to any lengths. And that hit me like a ton of bricks, you know, because I realized she was right. I really did expect, you know, this thing to just be handed to me on a silver platter, that it would happen by osmosis and that I didn't have to do the work or the effort. And she was right. And so I thought to myself, I remember thinking to myself, how do I go about getting willingness if I don't have the willingness? And it occurred to me that I could pray for willingness. And that's what I've done ever since then. Every single day when I ask for help in the morning, I keep it really simple. I ask God for the strength and the willingness to stay sober. And I've been given that willingness. And I am so grateful for that today. I mean, I never dreamt, you know, that I would be as sober as long as I am today. I never dreamt that I would live to be past 30, you know, let alone, well, I'm not going to tell you my age, but anyway. You know, I have gray hair now. I'm like one of those ladies that I used to make fun of. And, you know, it's amazing to me now. My life has been really good, and I am really, really grateful that I got sober at the age that I did. You know, when I first came in, people would say, "You're so lucky." And I would think, "No, I'm not." You know, this really stinks. I felt like my life was over, but it wasn't. And, I've had an amazing life sober. When I came back this last time, you know, I did things differently. I started to do things differently. You know, I started talking to a sponsor. I ended up working the 12 steps and actually doing the 12 steps and doing a fourth and a fifth and looking at myself and trying to trust another woman to do, you know, to listen to my fifth step. It's been a real slow, gradual process. You know, I really believe I've always been a slow learner in AA. I struggle with ego. I struggle with my pride. You know, and slow but sure, I've been letting that go and letting that go and letting people in. And it's been an amazing process. You know, a day at a time, no matter what has happened in life, you know, I try to keep life and sobriety separate. You know, they're intertwined, but life doesn't cause me to drink. You know, and drink, you know, and I had to learn that, you know, in sobriety. Good things have happened. At 12 years, I met my husband, at a meeting, and he had 6 years. We became friends and we started dating, and, you know, we dated for 3 years before we finally got engaged. And it's been an amazing journey. You know, we're coming up on our 12th anniversary, and I wouldn't trade him for $1 million. You know, he's been my absolute best friend, and we're absolute partners. And it's because we're both sober and we're on the same page and we're on the same spiritual journey that we have such a good relationship today. You know, work, you know, I've had different jobs, and I've absolutely put 110% on every job that I've ever had. You know, and that's been a blessing, an absolute blessing that I can do that, that I can be a functional member of society. You know, I don't always care for the place that I work, and I'm kind of presently in that situation, but I learn to deal with it. You know, I take that a day at a time, and I try to bring forth the best that I can each day to that job. I've become a friend to so many people, and so many people, you know, I'm amazed at how many people are in my life and women friends that I've made. You know, this is a gal who didn't trust any women when I came in here. And today there are women I would trust with my life, you know, and I am so grateful they're in my life. You know, it's just so many good things, so many good things. You know, I've had, you know, and the tough stuff that I've had to go through, I didn't have to go through it alone. You know, my father passed away 16 years ago. My mom passed away 12 years ago. 13 years ago, excuse me. And then my sister died 4 years ago. And that was my family, you know, and that was really tough stuff. When my sister died, I think it was one of the toughest things I've ever had to go through sober. But the blessing was I was able to hold her hand when she passed, you know, and I was able to, while she was passing, tell her she was loved, that I loved her, that God loved her, you know, and hope that it sent her in a peaceful state on her next journey. As difficult as that was, you know, the blessing that came out of that, because I'm sober, because I'm a functioning member of society, I could be there for my nephew, and still am there for my nephew, her son, her only son, and be a positive example to him and include him, you know, and we can include him in our lives. And he's a wonderful young man, and what a gift that's been. You know, if I was still drinking, if I wasn't dead by now, which I probably would have been, you know, I would not be a functioning member of society. I would be a burden, and I know that. You know, chances are I'd either be in jail or in a hospital, and that's where alcoholism takes us, you know, and I have to never fool myself about that. Today, I'm very grateful that I understand the nature of this illness and how it works in me, you know, that I can never, ever again take a drink in safety. That thought has been bashed from my head. You know, and what I do to stay sober today, I keep it really simple. I do the same things that I did in the beginning that you'll hear over and over and over again at meetings. You know, the simple suggestions. I don't drink, number one. That's the bottom, absolute bottom line. Don't drink no matter what. You know, I've had days where I've actually white-knuckled it, as they used to call it, you know, where I just hang on for dear life because I want to drink so bad. But I don't have to drink today, and I know that, no matter what. I ask for help from a power greater than myself. You know, I've been sober a long time, and I could not tell you what this higher power is. I don't have a great grasp on any religion, but I do believe, I absolutely believe that this higher power exists and is present at every single AA meeting. And I ask that higher power for help every day, and I believe I'm given that help. And I thank that higher power every night. I go to meetings on a regular basis. I don't, you know, I know that's where the sober people are, and it's important that I be there. And not just so that I can hear things, but so that I can also give back. You know, if I go to meetings on a regular basis, I learn who's new. You know, I'm able to reach out, give out my phone number, sponsor women, you know, try to be helpful, give an encouraging word like the members did to me when I was new. That makes such a difference, and it gives people little bits of hope every day, and I try to do that on a regular basis. I have a sponsor that I call on a regular basis, you know, and I still use her today, and she's become one of my best friends, and, you know, it still helps to keep me on track. Every now and then, this alcoholic mind can get a little bit off kilter, you know, if things are, you know, if I'm not feeling well, or if life throws a curveball, it's easy to get a little off kilter, and so she helps keep me on kilter, and I use her on a regular basis, and we chat on a regular basis. I have a group that I'm a member of, you know, and I'm active with that group, and that group is an important lifeline for me. You know, I feel safe at my meeting, and that's important. And it's also a chance for me to give back, to be active in my group and active in service. And the last thing that I do is I apply the 12 steps of recovery to my life. I'm not perfect at it. I you know, I'll be the first to admit that, but I'm constantly trying to practice them and do the best that I can and be the best person that I can be. I am absolutely not the same person that walked into those halls, you know, way back when. You know, today I'm a woman of honor and dignity. You know, I care about people. I have the ability to love, the ability to care, and I understand what's important in life, you know, and it's not all the material things. It's not, you know, how I look. It's none of that matters. You know, it's the person that's inside, the person, you know, that I always wanted to be and knew was in there, but didn't know how to act, didn't know how to live in the world. And I really feel like AA has given me like the book on how to live life. And if I don't have an answer, you know, chances are somebody else does, you know, and I just have to ask for help. And it's such a gift. You know, and one thing I always share, if anybody's new, you know, to buy yourself some sober time, keep coming to meetings, whether you want to be there or not, it doesn't matter. Keep coming. You know, they used to say, if you don't get AA, AA will get you. You know, this is a fellowship that works. You know, it's not the only thing that's out there to help alcoholics, but it's the most successful. And today, you know, I stick close and I have no plans of not doing so. And I have a good life today, and I have a lot more to lose today. So I stick close and I continue to go to meetings. And I think that's all I have to offer. Thank you very much for listening.